have Sammy Roth of the LA Times, who will be moderating this opening session. When Sammy is not busy with his regular reporting or his great weekly Boiling Point newsletter, which I read, he's probably checking the Los Angeles Dodgers box scores. Here's Sammy. And he'll introduce everybody on this panel.
Thank you. Thank you, Christy. And it was fun seeing the Salt and Sea story win the award there, just because before I was at the LA Times, I was in the desert in California at the Desert Sun newspaper and reported a lot on the Salt and Sea, which is a real important story. I'm going to introduce the panelists here, but before I do, just a real quick preamble to this discussion. You know, when I was in the desert in California, it was right about a decade ago, right at the beginning of like the first big solar boom that was happening in the United States. There were all of these, you know, big sweeping solar farms that were getting built on public lands in the Mojave Desert, and it was sort of surprising to me when I showed up there, because I went and, you know, just with a pretty simplistic mindset of, you know, great solar, we need it, this is awesome. And I was pretty surprised to see that it was, you know, there was this nuance. There were conservation groups out there in the desert that were raising concerns about some of these projects and asking, you know, what's the impact going to be to tortoise habitat and to these, you know, other wildlife values in the desert. There were tribes out in the desert that, you know, this was their historic territory. These were areas that were culturally important to them, who were concerned that these projects were getting built without a lot of consultation. And so, you know, this is a story that's kind of a national story now, especially now that the Inflation Reduction Act has passed and there's solar and wind and geothermal and batteries and power lines and critical mineral mines being proposed everywhere. And, you know, we clearly, every study that's looked at this, we need lots and lots and lots of this stuff to deal with the climate imperative. There's not really a choice about that, but it then becomes a question of where do you put it, what are the conflicts that, you know, might present themselves. And you know, I'm seeing this all over the country, and I'm sure many of you are seeing it where you live, and so this got started in California and has kind of gone everywhere. And, you know, just one more bit of framing here. Conveniently for our discussion, just this week, Bill McKibben, the sort of eminent environmental activist, had an essay in Mother Jones this week, which was really, really interesting, titled "Yes in Our Backyard," kind of making the argument that, you know, especially in the United States, which bears so much historic responsibility for the climate crisis and all of the carbon we've put into the atmosphere, that we need to do this sort of, this tough evaluation of, are there projects that we might have opposed for reasons in the past, that it's time to rethink that and time to say yes to stuff in our communities that we might have said no to previously. What he wrote, which I found so interesting, he wrote, "The general tactic used by the opponents of projects, delay until it goes away, is in effect a form of climate denial. Making the perfect the enemy of the good is, in such a case, more like making the perfect the enemy of anything at all," the argument being that climate change will lead to total disaster. So that's a provocative statement. I'm going to be curious what our panelists make of it. I'm going to be curious what you all make of it. We'll have time for audience questions at the end. I've been told SEJ and journalism group members get first priority at the microphones when we get to audience questions. Please identify yourself when you ask a question. No speeches, just questions, please. I've asked the same of our panelists, no speeches. And let me introduce them. We've got a great group here. Starting right here on my left, we've got Shannon Eddy, who's the executive director of the Large Scale Solar Association and industry trade group in California. We've got Justin Hayes, executive director of the Idaho Conservation League. We've got Tracy Stone Manning, who's the director of the United States Bureau of Land Management, who I'm very excited to have here. We've got Shannon Wheeler, who you all probably heard from the other night, the vice chairman of the Nez Perce Tribe. And Grace Wu, who's an assistant professor in the Environmental Studies Program at UC Santa Barbara and has done some really, really interesting research on this topic of where do we put all of the renewable energy we need, which I'm excited to get into. But let me start with Shannon Eddy, you know, right here. Shannon, you and I have spent a lot of time talking over the years about the need to build lots and lots of solar and other renewable energy. Let's look at the big picture here. How much stuff do we need? How much solar and wind do we need to actually get rid of fossil fuels? And how does electrification play into that? Because it's not just powering the needs that we have on the grid right now, it's also tens of millions of electric vehicles that are coming, electric homes, et cetera. What does that look like? How big is it really?
It's huge. First, just really happy to be here, and thanks for this. When we consider what it takes, you kind of answered the question. I mean, when you consider what it takes to electrify the transportation sector, to electrify manufacturing, ports, buildings, et cetera, and at the same time you're electrifying the grid, you get this really interesting dynamic I mean, if we were just electrifying the grid, that would be one thing. We would just replace what's there, and that would be, we'd be done.
Replace all the coal plants and the gas plants with solar and wind and batteries.
That's right. But the curve is accelerating at a rapid trajectory. And so let's just look at California as an example. I know those numbers off the top of my head. I know some of the national numbers. So California is decarbonizing across the sectors. Just last month, the PUC released a portfolio calling for 86,000 megawatts to be added to the grid in 12 years. Now, 39,000 megawatts of that is going to be solar.
How much do we have in the grid right now in California?
I'd say on a hot day, we're humming at about 50,000.
50,000 megawatts, so they want to more, the state says we need to more than double the size of that.
More than double. And then after 2035, between 2035 and 2045, we need to add another 70,000 megawatts to the grid. And that's just California.
So that's triple or quadruple right
yes.
there.
Yes, we okay. need a threefold growth, and that's keeping 26,000 megawatts of gas online. If you want to get all the gas out, then that's a fourfold growth.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
What does it look like on the ground? You know, you sent me an email last week while we were kind of preparing for this, and you wrote, while people love the idea of renewable energy, most don't love the actual projects. You know, it's a tough dynamic. What are you seeing in California as developers try to get project built? What does it look like on the ground?
It's tough. I would say that the opposition campaigns are getting more organized, they're getting more sophisticated, and pretty much projects are opposed no matter where they go. The projects that are close to urban areas are opposed by the people that see them in the urban areas, and when I say urban, I mean urban and rural. The projects that are sited out in, you know, away from the urban areas are then opposed by the ENGO community. And for the most part, projects are opposed by everybody everywhere.
So you've got people who don't want to look at them, people who are concerned about wildlife, tribes who are concerned about cultural impact, et cetera.
Right. And I think one of the biggest misunderstandings and that we're really coming up against is that people think that projects can just go somewhere else. You have counties saying, well, we will support only those projects that support our, you know, our electricity needs, but put everything everywhere else. Well, what if we did that with water? What if we did that with our food? And so there's a really interesting dynamic that's playing out where people only want to sort of get their own, but they don't want to shoulder the burden, if you will, of putting projects in their area for other areas.
I want to come back to this, but let me bring Tracy in here. Tracy, I mean, Bureau of Land Management, you guys oversee about 10% of U.S. land acreage. Does that sound about right?
We do, 1 in 10 acres.
1 in 10 acres. So that's a huge amount of land. You've got a goal that President Biden has set of issue permits for 25 gigawatts of renewable energy on public lands by 2025. At the same time, you've got the 30 by 30 goal, the America the Beautiful campaign, protect 30% of U.S. lands and waters by 2030. Those things aren't necessarily in opposition to each other, but it, you know, creates a balance that you have to strike. And, you know, then on the critical mineral side as well, you know, probably everyone's familiar, sort of the Thacker Pass lithium mine, which was permitted in Nevada on BLM lands before your tenure, but you've got proposals like that that are sort of controversial all over the country, and you've got a strategy as the administration for how do we produce more of the critical minerals that we need for the energy transition here in the United States. How are you going about balancing this stuff? Like at a high level, what's the strategy or what's the thinking for, you know, how do you balance the need for lots of renewables for more mines with the need to protect a lot more land?
It's the question, right? And it's what we do at the Bureau of Land Management. We balance things. The Thacker decision is a good example. We did defend that in court. We did issue the notice to proceed for that last month. It's going to supply 20% of the nation's lithium. It's lithium we need. And so part of the way we juggle and think about balance is, you know, where is the right place with the right set of circumstances to have a project? And we work closely with developers who come in the door and they say, we want to have it over here. And we think, whew, you might want to think about it over here instead. And for some scale, like, you know, 245 million acres is a lot. So we have room to develop what we need to develop and have public lands do our part for the country and do the conservation and the restoration that we need to ensure that the future has a healthy landscape in which to live, yeah.
This goal that you set, 25 gigawatts of renewables by 2025, help us conceptualize that. How much is that really in the grand scheme of that 245 million acres?
So let's look at, let's put it to scale. I've asked, and let's look just at solar. I asked some of our folks, hey, what does it take to get a gigawatt of power? And the answer was 6,000 to 10,000 acres a gigawatt, right? So you do the math and you're at 150,000 to 250,000 acres from 245 million acres, right? There is a way to do this well and appropriately. Now, obviously, there's lots of devil in those details, and this is a goal that the Congress and the President has set for 2025. So it's not like we're going to stop at 2025, but it is. My point is, it's doable.
Yeah. Well, my follow-up question was going to be, why not a lot more? We've got 245 million acres, and we need all these renewables. That's what you said, 250,000. That's a pretty small fraction.
People and money.
Meaning what?
Our ability to do the projects. So we're at work at about 68 projects right now that would deliver 32 gigawatts of power. We have 120 projects waiting. And they're waiting because we don't have people and staff to do the work.
Yeah. And we'll go into more detail about this a little later on, but you say it's all about looking at each spot and figuring out what's a good place and what's a bad place. What's the difference? I mean, I know it's more complicated than that, but I mean, you got a lot of journalists here who are going to be looking at these projects in their community. I mean, what are some of the high-level things you think about? What makes a spot good or not good?
We think about threatened and endangered species. We think about cultural artifacts. We think about how close it is to transmission and whether a bunch of infrastructure is going to need to come in order to deliver those electrons, for example. Things like that. I think, is it a migratory corridor and would block passage for important species?
I think we'll go into this more, but I feel like part of the issue here is just the more study is done of public lands. I mean, you guys just announced the other day, right, that you're going to be examining the health of all of the lands you manage in a more comprehensive way, right? And it just seems like the more study is done, the more every bit of land is looked at more closely. There's value of some kind almost everywhere, it seems.
Yeah, it just means we're going to be smarter and more informed about the decisions we're making and about the trade-offs we're making. Everything's a trade-off.
Let me, Vice Chairman Wheeler, I want to bring you into the discussion here on the mining aspect in particular. I went on the all-day tour yesterday, the mining tour that you spoke at, and you were talking about the Stibnite gold and antimony mine that's been proposed here in Idaho, and what can you do to make them adopt more environmentally friendly practices? And it's mostly gold, which is not really relevant to the energy transition, but there's some antimony which is relevant. And you made the comment talking about how you fighting to contain the damage from resource extraction while also knowing we need to fight climate change and we're going to need some minerals for that. And your words were, that's not a comfortable place to be. And I guess I'm sort of hoping you can expand upon that a little bit and talk about how you and how your tribe are viewing this question of needing to fight climate change, but also there's potential damage that can come from some of this mining that's needed.
Well, Katsuyaya, Sammy, thank you, Sammy, and Tatsmewi, Oikolohim Yumakalati Wama, Soyokatski Lahin Haniwat. So just good morning to everyone here. I know sometimes we forget to say that, and just to thank the Creator for this beautiful day that we're all here today. With that question, as we look at the different explorations, as there's the extraction of minerals that are needed to invest into the future for what we need to do to, slow down climate change and do our part. We're faced in a reactionary position to where, well, we do solar and we're deploying solar, we're doing siting and at the same time we're over here concerned about a mining operation that's having different effects on the environment, the water, ESA listed species. And so when we have to weigh that, it's like we're confined a little bit here and we're tugged at and that's a difficult place to be at. But you have to make decisions you know, what are we attempting to do here? You know, you should stop the bleeding here, you know, and if you're going to open something else up over here, it needs to be the best that we can do that moving forward. And so if we're mining and we're producing, you know, solar panels or deploying, I mean, for us, we're looking at rooftops versus commercial scale. That's ground that's already being used. We're looking at conservation of energy. That's really not a big part of the equation yet. It's all about deployment of renewable energies, and you know the physics of that. Is that going to be able to fit on these grids that are going to take 10 to 20 years to build out infrastructure where deployment we're looking at 1 to 3 years for development to happen. And so we start weighing all these different things. There's a lot to weigh, and that's what really pushes us into this area. So we try to take the most positive steps forward, if that's battery storage, of course, the microgrids that we're developing, taking energy off the grid. You know, we look for the federal government, state governments, tribal governments, universities to start doing that first. So efforts of conservation first that help stop that bleeding that we need to do. That, you know, can we do mining differently? Certainly we can. Do other countries do it better than us? Certainly they do. What can we do? What can we do differently? And I think so that's weighing everything and trying to move forward with caution, but at the same time we know that we have to move forward because the planet's telling us that we have to.
A follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. The, you know, it's, especially since we have Tracy here from the BLM on this panel, I'm so curious for projects that you've seen, you know, either renewable or mining that are proposed on federal lands that are you know, you're part of the, you know, Nez Perce's historic lands. I guess how good a job do you think the Bureau of Land Management and the federal government are doing or not doing collaborating with tribes and consulting with the Nez Perce and other tribes on these projects? I mean, what is it where it should be, or does more need to be done to bring you guys into the process?
Well, as I said yesterday, I think that's a part of the administration, the former administration. We were a check the box exercise. This current administration, we are, you know, being consulted, you know, often and early, and I think that's truly important to be able to identify the concerns that are out there. Because if you're looking at the traditional ecological knowledge that the tribes have, and where we've been in this space for thousands of years, then I think that information is good to have. And for, you know, for us, if we're going to have to contest something, that's going to slow a project down even more. So it'd be better to get all of your ingredients first and then start moving forward versus, you know, let's go forward and then we'll determine, you know, what the ramifications are after. And so we're glad that the administration is taking those steps to consult early and often.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up that point about, you know, what it looks like to move forward more quickly, and, you know, does slowing down help you go forward faster or not? I want to get into that conversation more in a few minutes. Before we do, Justin, you know, looking at specific examples here in Idaho for this conversation, I mean, so one, I'm really interested in the Lava Ridge wind farm. I'm going to be out there next week. This, for those who aren't familiar, this would be the biggest wind farm in Idaho. It's been proposed outside of Twin Falls on public lands. It's become controversial in part because of wildlife habitat and in large part because it's immediately adjacent to the Minidoka National Historic Site, which was a Japanese-American prison camp during World War II, and there's concern over sort of altering that historic viewshed. Your group, as I understand, hasn't outright opposed that project, but you've raised some concerns and some questions about it. And then mining as well, you know, the big Gervois cobalt mine that I think got started a couple weeks ago and then immediately stopped because cobalt prices took a dive, as I understand it. You guys have been working with that company rather than, you know, opposing that project to try to improve their practices, which I think is interesting. So I'm hoping you could talk about those projects and just generally the approach that Idaho Conservation League has taken in terms of, you know, opposing stuff versus working with developers and working with mining companies about how do we figure this out together.
Thank you. I'll just start by saying it's really hard. You know, there is tremendous urgency around climate. my organization. We're the largest conservation group in the state. We have a really diverse portfolio of issues that we work on. Climate is one of them. Our goal is to get Idaho to be carbon neutral. We also have a huge portfolio of work around protecting public lands and the wildlife and the communities that rely on them. So there is tension. We feel it in our own organization. We all do on this panel. And the communities that we work in also feel it. We are trying very hard to work with communities and developers to identify projects that can be done well in places that can sustain them, operationally done, in sensitive ways to the community, to the ecology of the area. We are trying to get to yes on things. And that is probably a different posture than an organization like mine might have taken a decade ago on some of this stuff. So as we try and get to yes, the first thing we have to recognize, though, is yes is not always going to be the right answer. Sometimes no is the only acceptable answer to something that's proposed in the wrong place, or in a way that is insensitive to the needs of the community or the ecology that can't be supported. With Lava Ridge, it's frankly a hugely controversial, very large wind project that's proposed in Idaho. And we need to figure out a way to get projects like that on the ground. And unfortunately, the interests that are concerned about this, whether it's wildlife, tribal concerns, the Minidoka internment camp concerns, or the local community concerns, we all have very limited tools to interact with these things. These are antiquated laws, frankly, that are driving a lot of this, and many of the areas where it's being proposed have, you know, very old management plans, whether it's a forest or a BLM district. So communities that have concerns are in a very reactionary mode with very limited tools to engage in a way that affects the outcome of the project other than to object to it. So trying to get to yes when the only option that people see as working for them is no is really, really hard.
You know, one thing that I wonder about quite a bit, and I'll open this question up in a few minutes to everyone here, but for now for you, Justin, do you see there as being more legitimate and less legitimate reasons to be opposed to a renewable energy project or a mine? Because it, you know, some of this stuff really runs the gamut on, you know, on you've got people who don't want to have to wake up and look at it because they feel like it'll change the rural character of their community. You have obviously habitat and wildlife migration corridor concerns, and then frankly you've got, you know, stuff that's more fueled by misinformation, which there's been reporting on. So how do you think about that? What's legitimate and what's not?
I do think about that, and I think each of us in our work can imagine things that feel important to us, and of course those are legitimate concerns, and things that are easy to dismiss, and those are illegitimate concerns. But in the end, I think we need to address all of the concerns that are raised, and anyone who is raising a concern has the potential to really slow a project down. So you get to decide whether you want to argue about whether someone's concern is legitimate or not, or we can figure out ways of addressing it so projects can move forward. I might have concerns about the effect of a project on migration of antelope. Someone else might have a concern about if they can see the project from their dining room window. And either one of those concerns can be used to slow the project down.
But if someone thinks that the blades from the wind turbine are going to fly off into their home, that might be a little different.
Yes, of course. But there's a set of concerns that people can use to slow projects down. You know, we can get into the argument about the opposition to woke energy. It didn't help anyone 4 years ago when then President Trump said that windmills caused cancer.
Oh yeah.
I mean, so some of those concerns are maybe they're out there.
I hear from those people. I do.
Those concerns are not likely to make their way through the permitting process in a way that slows the project down through, you know, successful appeals,
right,
or litigation and stuff. So the concerns that...
Right, but a county commission might vote no on a land use permit based on stuff like that. I mean, that's legitimate. I mean,
that is definitely happening in Idaho, and we're seeing it in Lava Ridge.
Grace, I really want to, and I'm sorry for saving you for last year, but I'm very excited for you to tell everyone about the research you've done, and then I want to bring everyone else in to comment on it, but so you were involved, you led a study at the Nature Conservancy, right, and I wrote about this last year, looking sort of across the western United States at, you know, sort of evaluating the land just, you know, across the 11 western states, where do we build, where do we protect, where do we site power lines? Talk about what your findings were there, because I think it's really relevant and it's sort of a, you know, a useful way to think about the big picture here.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So the major scope of that study was 11 western states, all net zero. So that includes what Chad and Eddie was mentioning, decarbonizing the transportation sector, ensuring that we're actually sequestering carbon when we need to through direct air capture. The main contribution to the study was to look at different levels of siting protection for both land and waters. And under the most stringent or the most protective scenario, what the good news says is that we can achieve conservation and our climate goals and deploy a very large amount of renewable energy, which is on the order of 700 gigawatts, which is mind-boggling.
How mind-boggling is 700 gigawatts? Put that in context.
So California, for example, has about 16 gigawatts of utility-scale solar. We need about, under the net zero scenario, siting level, the most protective scenario, we find that we need about 350 to 400 gigawatts of solar. And we can get into a little more about the utility scale versus PV, or we can talk
versus
or rooftop. Yeah, but it's about a 2-to-1 ratio of utility to rooftop was our major assumption.
So you're finding a need for a lot of rooftop, but even more utility, large solar farms.
Yeah, the main message around that is we need both. I hear from rooftop solar proponents. I also hear from rooftop solar opponents. Utility scale, we need a balance of both. The amount of development that we need is so massive that we can't do it with one sub-technology alone.
So when you say the most, you know, you looked at different levels of land protection, but to talk about that a little more. So you, as I understand it from when we talked at the time, I mean, your finding was that you could basically protect most places in most states and still have enough room to build. Was that the idea?
Yeah, so when I say most stringent or most protective scenario, we basically consulted with every Nature Conservancy chapter scientist and their team, and identified a priority list of legally protected, administratively protected, and high conservation values that don't have those legal or administrative protections, and basically ranked them, put them into these scenarios. And in the most protective scenario, where we conserve intact habitat, that is entirely possible, even with these ambitious goals.
Entirely possible to get to net zero.
Entirely possible. There are lots of nuances, cost being one of them. Second being a shift from wind to solar. So this shift is fairly dramatic in some states. Overall, it's about a 30% reduction in onshore wind and a commensurate increase in utility scale.
So you're saying basically so far in most places we've had a lot more wind built than solar, and that kind of, you know, not that we don't need more wind, but we really need a lot more solar is what you found.
The dynamic here is that wind takes up a lot of land area, not the turbines themselves, but the spacing. And so the total land use of a wind farm has a much greater likelihood because of its scale to come in contact with an area that has high conservation value, whereas solar is much more land use efficient.
But even with, I mean, a solar project, it really covers most of the land that it's on. Even with wind having all that space between, that's not, why does it matter if it's just the little, you know, turbine pads, and then if it's all open, isn't that okay?
That's a great question. We've been getting that a lot. TNC is encountering this. So a lot of wildlife have avoidance strategies around wind farms, not just the turbines. There is a certain distance buffer around the farms, the turbines, in which wildlife completely avoid or reduce activity. And for the species that we looked at, big game, migratory birds, endangered species, we found that there's quite a large area of avoidance around wind farms.
Interesting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that in the numbers that you came out with in this study, you did not include tribal lands, correct?
We deliberately excluded tribal lands through consultation with certain tribal representatives to respect the sovereignty of these tribal nations in determining how much renewable energy should occur on there.
But in theory, if there are tribes out there that want to site, you know, large solar or wind farms on their lands, that potentially makes it even easier.
Yes, of course. That opens up more opportunities for development.
So I want to go back to Shannon here, and then I'm going to open it up to everybody. Because Shannon, after I, for everyone's background knowledge, after I wrote about that study that Grace led at the Nature Conservancy, I heard from Shannon, who wanted to tell me all the things that she was frustrated by. I shouldn't put words in your mouth, I'm sorry, but I did a follow-up piece, which you can find if you want it, where Shannon and I talked about, what might have been missing from this analysis. And Grace, I'll give you a, definitely respond here too, but tell me what you think is missing from this analysis, this idea that if only we, if we could just map out all of the right places and, protect the areas that need to be protected and just say, hey, build solar here, here, and here. What does that miss? What did this study not do?
So when we look, and we're having this conversation not just about things like the TNC report, but also with multiple landscape level planning efforts that
sure.
are happening.
In California, we had the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan, right? 10 million right. acres sorting out conservation areas versus solar areas, which, by the way, the BLM is now looking at doing something similar across other states, but continue.
Yeah. And even California is looking at some sort of zonal planning for transmission and renewable energy. What a lot of these planning exercises miss are development feasibility indexes. So
meaning how feasible it is to actually build in some of these spots.
That's right. And so you have to find places. I mean, if you're going to build a project, you have to find a place that's within relative proximity to transmission. And not just transmission, but available transmission with available capacity.
You got to actually get the electricity where it needs to be used.
Absolutely. And we are transmission constrained. And we could have a whole conference on transmission. There are those. We'll set that aside for now. We have to think about parcelization. So because transmission is so constrained, developers and projects are being expected to shoulder longer gen tie lines and in some cases build entire substations. So that costs more money because you have to build bigger projects. Bigger projects have bigger footprints. Bigger footprints take up more parcels, and more parcels have to be negotiated across more landowners.
So if you've got 25 private landowners, that's harder than, say, public lands where there's one landowner.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so those are the kinds of things that need to be taken into consideration. And I think one of the things that we miss in landscape level planning is that it oversimplifies things. It makes it look very easy to say, look, we can just put projects here and we don't have to put projects there. But when it comes down to actually siting the projects and there are project level analyses that happen, there are often conflicts that can't be seen at the desktop level that we miss. And so I think landscape level planning is a nice guide, but it's not something we can totally hang our hat on, because when it comes down to it, we've got to site these projects on the ground, and on the ground analyses usually show something different.
The concern that I've heard you and many others, within the renewable energy industry express is that, if we do these kind of big analyses and stop and slow down and, look across states, look across the country and try to map out where should we build, where should we protect. The argument for that is, as Vice Chairman Wheeler said earlier, that it helps avoid conflicts later, but the argument against that I've heard is, as you're sort of articulating now, there might still be conflicts that make it hard to build, and then you've slowed yourself down, and then you've lost 5, 10, 15 years, and it's 2035 or 2045, and climate change is running away, and we haven't solved it. Who else wants to weigh in on this conversation? I mean, Grace, if you want to come back here, that's great, or if there are others who want to weigh in. I mean, how is this the right way to go about it? How do we actually do this at a large level, figure out where we can build stuff and where we shouldn't?
I do think that the question of scale is very interesting. We're seeing large projects because that's what developers need or want, mm-hmm. and connecting to the grid is a definite part of their cost. Here in the Pacific Northwest, there are about 95,000 megawatts of projects waiting in the BPA interconnection queue. So the federal agency, the Vulnerable Power Administration, that oversees the grid here, is quite frankly not doing enough to modernize the grid and create resources available for private developers and others who want to put in projects. And
that's across the country. Every grid operator basically has a big backlog of people who want to connect.
I'm sure that's correct.
There's not enough transmission to support all of it.
I'm sure that's correct. And the cost of connecting into the grid is such a barrier that the only people who are getting through are these really big projects. But they're not really getting through because they're running aground on permitting problems and conflicts in communities. So, thinking some about the scale at which we need to put these in the ground, smaller, more distributed projects might move through the system and become operational quicker than larger projects. It's just something to think about.
Grace, do you want to come back here?
An opportunity. So I do think that landscape level planning is not a substitute for feasibility studies and site-specific, the necessary site-specific studies that are required as part of the permitting process. It gives us, I think the powerful aspect of doing this is it gives us a landscape level view of what's possible, how much do we need, where approximately do we see more development. I think most importantly, it helps inform transmission planning, and that's the way that California has started to use these types of state level analyses.
So you're saying if you figure out where you can build the solar and wind, then that helps you figure out where to put the power lines
exactly.
To move it around. Okay.
And we actually do account for transmission upgrades, the cost of building a new substation, the cost of the spur or gentile lines. And in our last study, we actually did look at interregional long distance transmission, where to co-locate them, where to actually do reconductoring, and where the new lines should be. So these studies can get into the nuance and like the spatial specificity. Of course, that shouldn't be the end all be all. Those studies can inform future much more site-specific analyses.
Right, but we don't have a lot of time, right? I mean, it's 2023, it's gonna be 2035 before we all know it, unfortunately. Right, I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah, well let me ask Tracy to bring you back in here about speeding things up. I mean, there's been a lot of talk. I mean, Congress, and by the way, in about five, seven minutes here, let's start to take some audience questions. So if you've got questions, where are the microphones? In the next couple minutes, yeah, one over here. In the next like 5 minutes, if folks who have questions want to start lining up, we'll go to those. And remember, SEJ members and journalism group members get priority. Tracy, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, permitting reform in Congress recently. Talk about, you know, speeding up not just renewable projects, but potentially fossil fuel projects are being debated. But when it comes to, you know, figuring out how to move through this clean energy and these mining things faster, I mean, you know, just this last week, Bureau of Land Management gave permission to start construction to the Transwest Express power line, which is 730 miles. It's going to carry wind power from Wyoming to California. You know, it's sort of a big marquee transmission project, but it took 15 years. They spent 15 years going through 18. You're right, the earlier 18. 18 years going through the permitting process, which I get it, it's 730 miles and it crosses four states and it's, you know, a dozen counties and whatever, but, you know, that's a relatively smaller version of that is happening on just, you know, many, many solar projects and wind farms and lithium mines, et cetera. How do we speed that up? Does Congress need to do something? Is there things that you guys can do administratively? And how do you do it without sort of running roughshod over the environmental analysis process and over tribal input and all these other things that you need to take into account?
I think that the first thing that Congress can do is support the president's budget that increases our renewable energy management program by 77%, right? To get the people who are smart and good at what they do out on the ground doing the analysis on these projects that are stacking up, right? And in my mind, from where I sit, NEPA and permitting is not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is having enough people to do the work. And so that's why the president's budget reflects that need, right? So that's low-hanging fruit in my mind.
Justin?
Pull this forward and think about how do we get to yes on these projects in communities? Because, you know, good NEPA, good siting from some perspective, connecting to the grid, these are all really important things. But then when we find opposition to them that becomes the break on the system, how do we get to yes? And so I think that classically projects benefit a few financially. Could be the developer, it could be investors, it might be the tax roll, the local community, maybe someone gets a job. And then there are other folks in communities, or maybe it's the ecology of the area, maybe it's a tribe, maybe it's a town, private landowner, who feel harmed by its presence. So how do we spread out the benefits of these projects as a way of getting people to yes? So are there opportunities to ensure that the concerns that are being raised by affected parties don't only result in the project being tweaked a little bit so it harms them less? Is there an opportunity to create projects that actually provide benefits to people who perceive that they will be harmed by them? And I don't think we've done a very good job of grappling with that at a societal level or policy level. It goes way beyond the role of BLM in permitting, though, because, you know, our classical role with you guys is avoid conflict, minimize it, and mitigate it. And that really is an ecological frame to ensure no net harm to the ecology in the area. But you know, shaping a project so it's not quite as offensive to people who are concerned about it is not the same as providing a benefit to that community to get them to yes and move them forward.
Vice Chairman Wheeler, I think you wanted to weigh in here.
Yeah, thank you, Sammy. I think one of the things that we look at, of course, we've done some work with the state of Washington on solar siting, where we take in the considerations of agriculture communities, ranchers, and environmental groups, tribal groups, and grading our scoring areas of potential siting. And so we'll do that clear across the whole state. And then we'll overlay these maps on one another, and then whatever one comes up in the aggregate with the highest number, those are potential sites. And now we have all the grid and the transmission lines placed within that. So that's one way, one thing that we're doing with the state of Washington. I guess another thing that we look at is, of course, is the physics of it and the grid's capabilities. And if we're looking at bringing on X amount of megawatts of generation of new power, while we have competing power, we have hydro, we have nuclear, we have wind, we have solar, we have all these different competing energy sources, natural gas and coal and all these other, you know, these older generators. I think one of the things is that we have to really look at how we utilize energy. You know, in the Pacific Northwest, we'll utilize hydro when we could be utilizing solar. So they're pushing hydro electricity onto the grid. You know, it's carbon free, but it's not environmental free. It burns fish, and so one of the things
that's part of this conversation, right? There's no source of energy that has no impact, so we've got to weigh all of it, right?
Yeah, and how we do energy in this country. I mean, you know, when are we running our trucking industry? I mean, are we running them at nighttime, charging them during the day, and you know, so all these different things that we're looking at, and are we utilizing all of our solar when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing? You need all of these different energies still to be able to meet the demands of the electricity that we're utilizing as a country and as Natitiwit, as human beings, that this is what we've come to depend on. But we really need to look at those different things of how we transition. You know, it's just sometimes, you know, some of us want cold turkey off of coal and natural gas, but at the same time, can you actually do that? Is this something that, you know, you have to transition in because of the capabilities of the grid? And if we're talking 10 to 20 years or 18 years for build out for right of ways or easements on this, then we need to do some conservation in areas that how we utilize that energy, when we're using it, and where we're using it. So I think those are important factors in the considerations of how we do energy.
Well, one more here, and then I'm going to turn it to the audience questions. You know, talking about conservation and being smart with how we use energy, bringing it back to the mining, Tracy. You know, there's been a lot of talk about, I mean, your agency and the administration's goals about the need to source more, you know, to source more lithium, nickel, cobalt, you know, graphite, whatever is needed for batteries and for solar and for wind turbines in the United States. I mean, so much of this mining now happens in other countries, in other parts of the world where there are, you know, really, really serious negative environmental impacts and labor abuses and all human rights violations and all sorts of stuff. Would you say that in the United States we have a responsibility to source more minerals domestically? And if that's not the way you think about it, how do you think about that?
I think the president's been pretty clear that we need to do that, right? We need to ensure sort of energy security for the future. And one of the ways to do that is to do responsible development at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this whole conversation collectively suggests, you know, what the audience already knows. Yeah, change is hard. We're changing an entire economic system because energy underlies everything we do.
I like to tell my friends all the time, everything's an energy story. It comes up constantly.
Everything's an energy story. And we're doing it with a suite of existing laws that were not created for this time.
Right, like the general mining law of 1872, which we could have a whole other conversation about. Actually, I'll just bring this up. I don't know if anyone wants to comment, but there was a really interesting study a couple of months ago. I didn't write down who did the study, unfortunately, but it was looking at, you know, if we invested in mass transit and made cities more walkable and did battery recycling in a really robust way, that the finding was that you could potentially reduce the need for additional lithium mining by 90% in the United States, which I thought was really interesting and speaks to this. Grace, I don't know if you had any thoughts on that or wanted to weigh in, but you're nodding over there.
Yeah, I feel like the demand side strategies, what we've been talking about, are very much underemphasized.
Demand side meaning how we use energy.
How we use energy, how much of it, energy efficiency, smart cities, all like walking, just all these ways that we can reduce energy consumption has not received the limelight. Supply side, this is speaking like specifically about IPCC report, they did not even have a demand side chapter until the last iteration. So I think that the only no impact strategy, climate solution, is demand side strategy.
Right, but even if we do that, from your research and others, still need a tremendous, unprecedented build out of physical stuff.
Those studies that we rely on for estimating supply side do assume very aggressive electricity efficiency, but it doesn't look at these structural changes in the economy so much. It basically says we have a certain amount of electricity we have to meet. We don't look at large-scale reduction in transportation energy reduction, for example.
So I've promised some audience questions. Let's start over here on the right, because it looks like there are more people in that line.
Good morning. Fascinating discussion. Thank you. I'm Robert McClure. I'm an independent journalist in Seattle. I was previously a co-founder of Investigate West. And I really appreciate the discussions here this morning. I want to point out, though, that almost the entire discussion has been about building large, usually remote, wind and solar facilities and the transmission facilities to get them to the consumers. And I agree with you, Ms. Wu, that there also should be a lot more emphasis on the demand side. What I haven't heard a lot of discussion up here this morning is what we're going to do about increasing distributed energy. Vice Chairman Wheeler, I was glad to hear you talk about commercial solar on top of rooftops. Just think of the potential for that and the microgrids that could share that with apartment dwellers nearby. And Ms. Wu, I was really glad that you brought up the fact that we need both. But given that we now have...
If you could ask the question.
That we now have emerging battery technologies and also emerging technologies to reduce or eliminate curtailment, why isn't that getting more attention, the idea of rooftop solar pretty much everywhere?
So I'll just start really briefly here, and I appreciate that question because I think a lot of people are asking that, and it's a good question. You know, I've done a lot of reporting in California, especially on rooftop solar and the stuff that the, you know, investor-owned utility companies in California and elsewhere are doing to try to disadvantage rooftop solar. That's a huge, important conversation. I will say that every comprehensive large-scale study that I've seen looking at what it's going to take to get to net zero and get off of fossil fuels finds ridiculous amounts of both, of large solar and wind and rooftop. For what that's worth, Shannon, I don't know if you want to weigh in here or if anyone else does, but that's what I've seen.
I mean, we need everything. We need everything as fast as we can get it. For California, we need 33, and the projections are for 33,000 megawatts of rooftop that'll be built in the same time period that we're looking at 70,000 megawatts of utility scale. So we're not talking about it here just because this conversation's been focused a little bit on the utility scale side. We need as much rooftop as we can get. And Sammy's right, the incentive structures for that are a little bit different. It's also about three times as expensive as utility scale, so we have to think about the economic propositions as well.
And if you were at last year's SEJ, I did a plenary that was all about that, so go back and watch the video of that one. Let's go over here. Is that Bobby over there?
Hi, I'm Bobby McGill at Bloomberg. Thank you for this discussion. So you guys have focused mainly on the West, and I'm wondering if you might be able to apply landscape-level renewables planning to the East Coast. And so I live in rural southern Pennsylvania, where farmlands are quickly selling out to solar developers. So we're, you know, around where I live, we see a lot of whole valleys actually being transformed into large-scale solar. And the opposition to this locally is based on the solar being a sign, essentially, of the loss of a way of life. So there's a lot of cultural opposition. And I'm wondering if you can address how to bring some of these people on board, if they see large-scale solar as an affront to their culture and these long cultural traditions that have sort of defined the place for you know, well over a century. And also, how would you overcome some of the land use planning and zoning challenges in those areas?
Thank you, Bob. I find the agriculture question especially interesting because, and I've done some reporting on this in California, where part of the argument for solar on the ag land is, well, this is land that's already been disturbed, already been, you know, sort of fundamentally changed environmentally, so rather than going on pristine habitat somewhere, you know, why don't you do it on farmland? And yeah, it gets to exactly what you're saying, which is a lot of these communities that have built their, you know, their identities and their livelihoods around farming. You know, some farmers are embracing it and signing leases and it's lucrative for them, and others are doing exactly as you say. So I don't know who, you know, if anyone here wants to weigh in on this. Okay, at the end, your Vice Chairman Wheeler and then Grace too.
Just some of the solar deployments that we have that are on the ground. We have gardens growing and foods growing in between each of the rows that we've planted. And we, it's near a wastewater treatment plant, so all of the water that's going into that is coming out of the wastewater treatment plant as well.
Just to put in a plug for a study that's about to be released in a few weeks.
This is on the record, just so you know.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I am allowed to say this. No results, but it will be released. We have a PowerPlace national study that includes the rest of the continental U.S., and we do look at this question of where should we deploy agrivoltaics, how much potential is there, how much farmland will it take to actually reach net zero U.S. goals. And I think, speaking to an audience of journalists, I don't read enough positive stories of how solar development and wind development is benefiting rural communities. I hear a lot of bad news about opposition. And with the forthcoming deployment, you know, like the actual realization, the IRA incentives, a lot of those development, those projects are going to rural communities that are energy communities. How are they benefiting from this?
Energy communities, meaning they had a coal plant or a coal mine that they
exactly. lost. Exactly. I would love to see a story of wind turbines going on an abandoned coal mine. I haven't seen anything because they're about to happen, but I would love more coverage of those of the, that type. I think it addresses the reputational problem that energy new development has. And as a consumer of media, I think that those good news stories really, like, then amplify.
You heard it here. If you do that story, you've got at least one reader, promised. No, I agree. It's a good story. Justin, did I see you?
Yeah, I just like to say, I think this is a real point that's of great concern. There are people in this country who feel like they are being left behind. And shiny solar panels on the field next door is a very physical manifestation of change. And so change is really hard. And, you know, back to my overarching theme of how do we get to yes on this stuff, we really need to be bringing people with us, not leaving people behind. It's community.
Yeah, Shannon, please.
So I want to add to that because I think that's crucial. I mean, one of the really interesting dynamics that's happening is that the decarbonization targets are being set at the state levels, and then it's sort of relegated to the local governments and the renewable developers to duke it out and figure out how to make this happen. And that's an old mindset that we have to figure out a way to transcend. If we are going to reduce climate emissions globally by 50% in 7 years, everything needs to change.
2030, 7 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a really thoughtful conversation that we needed to have 20 years ago. And we are now in a situation where we need to build as much solar everywhere that we can. We are talking about the biggest shift in land use patterns in modern history. And so the question is, how do we all support? How do we get the environmental community to support these? How do we get the federal government, the state government, how do we launch a massive education campaign to help people understand why these projects are needed? And we're just talking about projects. We haven't even touched on transmission. Transmission lines take a tremendous amount of time to build, and they're even more controversial. And so you're putting your finger right to me on the most important question. Because if we cannot bring the public all across the board to support these together and educate and somehow unify, then we're not going to make it. And this is what unifies us. We have differences of opinion across the board. The one thing that unifies us is that we want to and we need to combat climate change. And if we don't do that through renewable energy, this isn't going to happen.
Thank you, Bobby. Let's go over here.
Hi, I'm Rachel Cohen. I'm a reporter at Boise State Public Radio. I have been reporting on the Lava Ridge Wind Project, and I think this question builds on this discussion well, but I'm curious about what can be done to bring more benefit to local communities, specifically when projects are proposed on public lands. I think building on Justin's point earlier, what can we do to bring more benefit to those communities that have concerns? And I just think there's a difference when a project is proposed on federal land versus someone's private land and the cost that they themselves receive from, the benefit that they receive from that project. Like, have you heard of different policy mechanisms and financial mechanisms to bring more direct benefit to those communities when the projects are proposed on public land?
Rachel, thanks for the great question. Tracy, I think I'd love to hear from you on this one, and only in part because you guys are currently evaluating Lava Ridge, and I think the public comment deadline just closed yesterday or today.
It did.
But broadly, what's your take on that?
Yeah, it did, and this gets back to Bobby's question, right? Change is hard, and this proposal represents change. Our job is to listen. I'm so pleased that the BLM Idaho has literally met 55 different times with groups or big public meetings, right? We have listened hard. And the draft alternatives that you saw as a result of that listening are very different than the original proposal.
This is the environmental impact process,
Exactly. And so now we're taking the public comment, listening again. We'll do our work to take in all that comment and see what's appropriate. The financial investments are, again, we come back to this this notion of we're doing this with laws that were built for other things. There's definite tax advantage, right, to local communities. There will be dollars that flow into local communities as a result of this infrastructure. But we don't have a renewable energy law in this country that says here are the things that you have to do to help local communities get to yes in my backyard. Mm-hmm. We are implementing these projects through FLIPMA, right, which was made in 1976. So it's a coming back to Bobby, change is hard.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned FLIPMA, because I was going to make a FLIPMA joke if you didn't. So that's.
And I also can't believe I said the acronym and not the words.
Federal Land Policy Management Act, right? There's an and in there. Jay, do we have a hard cut at 10:15 here, or can we go a couple extra minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to our next question.
Thank you.
Let's go to our next question over here.
My name's Emily. I cover energy for the Texas Tribune, and I unfortunately just did a story about rural opposition to renewable energy development. But
nothing a lot of these, it's a real story.
Yes, a lot of these rural and agricultural type people are supporting a law in Texas that's being debated right now that restricts how development can happen. It's like 100 feet from a fence line or 200 feet from a residence. So I wonder, on the subject of laws, are there state laws or local laws that you have seen that are productive in your views, or are there laws that you would like to see that you think would aid this conversation?
Who wants this one?
We do not have any productive laws in Idaho.
No productive laws in Idaho, but Grace, you're interested.
On this topic.
Okay.
NYSERDA, so the New York. So New York passed an act a couple of years ago during COVID, so I don't think it got much attention. It's the Accelerated Renewable Energy Community Benefits Act, and it created an Office of Renewable Energy Siting. So that's landmark. Every state should have one of these. The other aspect of this is that it ensures that there's procedural justice associated with every project that they permit, which is also revolutionary. I don't think there's anything like that anywhere else.
Procedural justice, what does that mean?
Meaning that there's consultation at various stages of the permitting process, there was evidence that they actually engaged with the community and that they ensured a specific level of benefits that was transferred to the community. I don't know the letter of the law. There's been very little news coverage on this, so I'd love to actually learn more, but I would say that it's kind of the first of its kind as it's part of it's been passed. So that's my best example of something like that that's in place.
Just to highlight, the IRA did direct, this is not quite germane, but the IRA did direct energy communities. So there are incentives to build in these sort of more disadvantaged communities to provide some uplift there economically. As Tracy pointed out, there is an economic benefit from the projects that flows to the local governments.
It was an incentive, so if you build in like where there was a former coal plant, you get extra tax incentive or something to that effect, right?
That's right.
Thank you for the question. Let's go over here.
Hi, my name's Erin Braun. I cover the West for The Economist. It's nice to see some of you who I've talked to before. I think it's fair to say that permitting is a hotter topic than it ever has been before. And Director Stone Manning, I know you've mentioned that staffing you feel like is the real bottleneck. I'm wondering if you can kind of explain how low staffing manifests in the BLM's field offices, like what you hear from your agents, and if there's a specific project that you can point to that maybe its timeline has suffered because of lack of staffing.
I can point to 120 projects that are waiting in line. They're literally sitting on desks because there are 68 projects in front of them, and there's only us. We have a finite number of staff who can do that work, and so it's hard to say to a company, "See you in 2 years." And you know whose phone rings when we say that? Mine.
What's your phone number?
We need people to do the work. I'm very interested in the permitting conversation that's happening in Congress. We're going to watch that very closely. But we also need people to do the work.
Jay, do I got to cut it off here? Can I? Okay. I'm sorry to our two remaining.
Quick last word, perhaps.
Just a quick last word. I'm sorry to our two people in line here. Very quick last thing. All the journalists in the room who are going to go home and cover this stuff, real high level, what should they be thinking about approaching these stories about renewables and about mining and about permitting? What's an important question they should ask or something they should make sure that they're thinking about with every story? Just go down rapid fire here.
Ask yourself, how can we see these projects as something other than harmful? Let's not presume harm. How do we get to yes? How do you get to yes? You're our storytellers. You're our observers. You help the narrative.
Justin.
Providing communities and agencies the tools to engage in this work well, whether that's funding or basic rules and laws, so that we have access to the things that we need to bring these projects online.
Tracy.
This country can do big things.
Vice Chairman.
Development generally outpaces regulation, and we're hearing a lot of that right now. And I think what's happening with the amounts of development that is being produced, the grid is still tied up by leasing space on there. And many large companies own that space already. Even if they're not using it, they control that space.
Grace.
Success permitting stories and how we can learn from them.
Thank you, everyone, for this great discussion. I really appreciate it. Hope everyone enjoyed.
Good job.